It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Renee Ritchie's here. Alex Lindsay, Andy Iannocco. We're going to talk about Supreme Court hearing yesterday on Apple's monopoly status. Apple's patent over health monitoring in your bed. Ooh, that sounds interesting. And the death of the Montreal bagel. Can it be so? It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 638, recorded Tuesday, November 27th, 2018. Scam Club. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Slide Belts by Brig Taylor. High-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. If you want a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit and use the code TWIT for 20% off. And by WordPress, reach more customers when you build your business website on wordpress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. Get 15% off any new plan at wordpress.com/MacBreak. And by PayPal, your trusted payments partner for today and tomorrow. PayPal processes over 25 million payments per day. Visit paypal.com/growth and sign up for free to set up a business account today. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple with Renee Ritchie from iMore.com and the Vector Podcast. Hello, Renee.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
I am well. Getting ready for a big community day.
Oh, yes. The biggest one ever.
Uh-huh. That's what, Saturday? Starts Friday?
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to admit, I finally got the little Meltan guy from the Pokemon Let's Go and transferred him over. And it looked like it would take weeks to evolve him. So I just spent all my rare candy, Leo. I evolved him immediately. I have no patience for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I have such poor impulse control. I never have more than one or two rare candies available anyway. Yes. We're talking about Pokemon Go, and I'm very, very sorry. I got the little ball. Florence Ion.
Yeah, me too.
You did? Yeah. So you put the Meltan in the ball from the Let's Go ball?
There's a Mew that comes in the ball, I believe. But I just got him and evolved him. You had to do a quest to get him, Leo. And then I had no more patience.
You're so next level Pokemon Go. I feel like such a punter next to you. I'm just happy to spin my ball and throw. Come on, you're sick of it by now. You just have to keep doing it so that the coverage continues.
I mean, it's still a juggernaut. Like, if you look at the raw numbers on how much interest this stuff generates, it's ridiculous. It's like the perfect storm of childhood nostalgia with modern AR curiosity and geographic-based community gameplay. And it just, like, there's hundreds of millions of people still going to these events. It's nuts.
I see people all the time. Somebody called me on the radio show, a mother who does it with her daughter. She was all excited about Community Day.
That was the first weekend it came out. We met these people in the park, and they said, "Oh, you know, my daughter wants to go play Pokemon with me. She never wants to spend any time with me. Yes, I hope this game never ends."
And how many billions of miles? They've released the figure every once in a while. Yeah. People have walked thanks to Pokemon Go, which you have to think is a huge improvement in overall health of geeks everywhere.
And I actually know where the parks are near me. I never knew where the parks were near me before.
I love getting gifts from you because they're from all these interesting spots in Quebec. Andy Iannocco, who is too wise and venerable to play Pokemon Go, is also here. Iannocco.com, Iannatko. Great to see you from public radio in Boston.
Yes, the mighty WGBH. And I'm not too wise to do Pokemon. It's more like some people should own boats and go through all the trouble of owning a boat. Some people would much rather just have a friend who owns a boat and hear all the wonderful stories about boating and occasionally get to be on the boat for the cost of a 12-pack of beer. So that's I'm enjoying the boating lifestyle through my friends like you.
Vicariously.
Vicarious Pokemoning. Also with us from D.C., I think. No, it looks like you're up in British Columbia.
I decided if I could put anything back there, why not get? I'm starting to get in the festive spirit. You know, we've finished Thanksgiving, I haven't put the lights on yet, but you know, we just got some trees back there. Figured, what the heck?
Very pretty. Pixelcore.com. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard arguments on a very oddball case, if you ask me. This is a lawsuit against Apple that accused it of breaking federal antitrust laws by monopolizing the market for iPhone software, for iPhone apps, and as a result causing consumers to overpay. The justices heard an hour of arguments yesterday. Apple appealed a lower court decision that would... Now, remember, this is just to allow the class action lawsuit to go forward. This is not on the merits of the lawsuit, but whether this class action lawsuit could even be filed. It was filed in 2011 by a group of iPhone users seeking monetary damages. Now, you know how we feel about class action lawsuits. Generally, they benefit only the lawyers who are filing them. And anybody who's been a beneficiary of a class action lawsuit knows at best you're going to get an iTunes gift card for 59 cents. But I think it's interesting that the lower court said that the suit could continue. The Supreme Court, in fact, according to people who listened to the arguments, seemed like they were also inclined to let it continue. The lawsuit said Apple violated federal antitrust laws by requiring apps to be sold through the App Store and then taking a 30% commission. Thoughts, gentlemen?
I mean, yeah, I think developers reading this are just crying, going, 30% of what? 30% of what? Yeah. No one's paying for our apps.
Yeah.
Well, it's another case. Go ahead, Alex.
I was going to say is that we're not talking about the merit of the case because there is no merit to this case. The we have never paid so little for so much as what we have now on our phones. I mean, when you look at compared to what we used to buy and what we used to pay $50 for or $60 for on our laptops and what we still sometimes pay on a desktop, what we pay now for what we're getting, it is definitely, it may have hurt the developers. It is not hurting the consumer. You know, we get an enormous amount of value for very little, and the Apple's take of that is not really what's affecting that. I think it's more the culture of what people are willing to pay. And I think that also the issue is that the idea that they have a monopoly over it is like saying Sears has monopoly over what you can sell at Sears. I mean, you know, the idea that you know, Apple, the advantage of Android existing is that Apple is a minority stakeholder. I mean, in the market, you know, if you don't like this market, the majority of people are using another platform. So I don't think there's any value in the actual lawsuit. But what is at stake is whether you can and what the Supreme Court is really looking at is who's the relationship with. That's all they're deciding. Who's the consumer relationship with? Is it with the end seller or Apple? And I will say that I generally think that the Ninth Circuit Court is kind of a Mickey Mouse Ralph Nader court. You know, like anything that like this that will go through, the Ninth Circuit Court will approve. But I do think the Supreme Court, even a conservative Supreme Court, may side with the plaintiffs on this, not on the plaintiffs, on the defendants in this case, who will be the future plaintiffs, because I think that the relationship is a little murky, you know, between, you know, while you're buying from a vendor, most of us don't even know who that vendor is. We buy the app on the phone. We have almost no relationship with that, you know, with the vendor. And so I think that it is going to be hard, an uphill battle for Apple to win this, from a liberal or a conservative court.
Yeah, it's another instance of the law is hysterically funny, because you think it's a simple issue, but then you look at the arguments and you realize that, yeah, this is why you have to go to law school for a number of years. Not because reality is that complicated, but because legal arguments, if you really, really want to win, you have to pick and choose how you fight your battles. And it can't be literally the way that the argument is being presented. So all the skepticism that the Supreme Court has been reported on about the hearings yesterday was about Apple's argument that the case should be thrown out on the basis that the consumer does not have a relationship with Apple. The business relationship is between the consumer and the app developer. And the precedent they're citing for this is the signature case regards the selling of bricks. That can a consumer sell the manufacturer of bricks because a bricklayer made a bum wall for them? And they're saying, well, no, the consumer didn't buy the bricks from the brick manufacturer. They bought the wall. The bricklayer bought the bricks and then sold a service containing bricks to the consumer. And all of the, with only like one exception, according to the news reports, they all said, I don't think that's the same thing at all. the argument that the suit is trying to make is that, and this is the other problematic thing on their side, is that they're saying that because there is absolutely no alternative but to go through the App Store to buy apps, because there's no other way to develop apps for the iPhone and the iPad, because there's no way to avoid that 30% tariff, so to speak, on every single app, the developers are forced to pass additional prices on to the consumer. And I don't know how, and I don't know if the case gets to that state, how much luck they're going to have suggesting that all these apps that cost a dollar, that cost nothing, compared to, I think really all, if it does go that far, I think Apple just has to produce ads from any issue of Mac User or Mac World from the mid 90s and show them how much a text editor cost back then, and show them or any ad for Palm Trio apps back in the day, how much did a simple spreadsheet that did practically nothing cost? Would cost $50.
It would be my sticky notes app cost $30, Andy.
Yeah, but I do think to wind it up, I do think that it's an important thing to be argued that the Android doesn't have this problem because there's a switch buried deep into settings that says this is a really dumb idea, but if you touch this switch, which we're telling you is a dumb idea, you'll be able to sideload apps from any source everywhere, and that's dumb and dangerous and you really shouldn't do it, but okay, you're a functioning adult, we will let you do that. And we also see the problems that were solved by Apple not making the App Store mandatory on macOS, when a company like Barebone Software decided that we are being put through all kinds of terrible gymnastics, forced to work on so much code for our app that does nothing but serve the interests of the of Apple's App Store, and taking away from our time making services and features that will benefit consumers. We've decided that we would much rather spend all that time on making sure that our consumers are happy, as opposed to Apple's App Store guidelines are happy, and they're free to do that, whereas they're not free to serve their customers that way if they were doing iOS apps. So I hope this question gets answered in one shape or form, but realize that when you talk about at this stage Apple being, quote, losing the battle, they're basically just having one argument that they were making kind of kicked to the curb, and it just will rely on what gets allowed to go to get argued next, as opposed to ending or winning or losing it totally.
Right. I mean, and the issue is that in any legal battle, you never know how that end battle is going to go. So no matter how obvious this may seem to us, that the silliness of this suit on many levels, the issue is Apple is, of course, going to look for, any good lawyer is going to look for all the little things, all the motions that they can file before we even get to that court case. Because once you're in a court case, there's no guarantee. And no matter how good you think your court case is, there's no guarantee you're going to come out on the other side with the right judge or with the right jury that's going to give you your decision. So what you want to do is try to invalidate. And these motions are very common. The fact that it got all the way to the Supreme Court is kind of amazing. It sounds like Apple did shoot it down at first, and probably if it had been anywhere else in the country and didn't go through the Ninth Circuit, it probably would have not made any further.
This is not what they're deciding. So let me just to be clear, what the Supreme Court is deciding is standing. And this comes back to the issue of who has the right to sue. And it goes back to this brick case. The Illinois Brick Company was being charged under the Sherman Antitrust Act with monopoly because they price fixed bricks. And the Supreme Court in 1977 ruled that only direct customers of the brick company had the right to sue. The U.S. government did not have the right to sue because they weren't buying the bricks directly. And so what happened is Apple was sued, and the issue that Apple fought over was, well, the class action has no merit because it's not from people who are directly affected by this. It's by indirect purchasers. And under Illinois Brick, they don't have standing to sue. The Ninth District ruled that they did. That's what the Supreme Court has decided. It's not going to decide the issue. The case if the Supreme Court upholds the Ninth Circuit decision, it merely means that the class is valid, that they do have standing to sue. And it looks like the justices in the Supreme Court feel that way. Neil Gorsuch did not, apparently, but he wondered whether – actually, no, I'm sorry, he did. He wondered whether the 1977 ruling was still valid in the modern marketplace. Justice Roberts' question suggested he agreed with Apple. Neil Kavanaugh apparently did not. Eleanor Kagan, who is one of the so-called liberal justices, although I don't think we should really characterize him that way, said, from my perspective, I've just engaged in a one-step transaction with Apple. The issue is if 30% goes to, I think the issue is if 30% goes to Apple, do the developers then pass that cost on to everybody else, to people who are buying apps? In other words, do you pay more for apps because of Apple's cut? And if the class, and I think that's what the class action suit is essentially based on. But again, it's up to the Supreme Court to allow that suit to go forward. At that point, many years in the distant future, this case will be decided by a lower court. So they're deciding whether the lawsuit could go forward based on, completely based on the standing of the plaintiffs.
And as I said, I mean, Apple, what Apple's doing is they're going to throw everything at this because, you know, this affects their larger business model. Regardless of how stupid the case is, the standing has delayed that case by 5 years or 6 years. So it was filed in 2011. Just this one little bit has pushed it out, you know, five or 6 years as it worked through there. So that's been, you know, and Apple will kick it down, you know, if they can delay it by another 5 or 6 years over another motion, they will, you know,
Apple
and
also
there's
does
no reason.
Some other weird things. For instance, all prices have to end in 99, like $4.99. You can't charge $5. And it means, and the lowest price could be 99 cents. That may be another bone of contention. Well, why can't we have a 50 cent app? That's all going to be down the road. This Supreme Court case isn't even that. It's just whether they're standing.
Right. Oh, and there's huge ramifications too, because there are places like, again, like Alex mentioned, Walmart, you're buying from Walmart. You're not buying from every single vendor in Walmart. And Amazon, their marketplace has traditionally been, they won't even charge you. Like they'll manage the store and they'll do all these things, but they'll also tell you what price it's going to be and they'll give it away for free if they feel like it and you can say thank you. So I think it's going to have wide ranging ramifications way beyond Apple.
I don't know if I understand that argument that you guys are making. I mean, it's not that you have the ability to go buy imagine that your house is your iPhone, that you don't have to buy all of your appliances from Sears because you can buy appliances from anywhere and install it inside your phone. Whereas with the iPhone, it is the case where you can't buy, you're forced to shop at this one store for apps. If a developer wants to sell someplace outside of Sears, they're not allowed to do that. So I don't think it's a silly concept of suing on this basis. I really hope that this is decided one way or another. Because it does come down to the right of ownership, where I think if you've spent $800 on this phone, do you have the right to install whatever software you want from it from any source? Or are you essentially buying permission from Apple to buy more apps from them?
Isn't that how game consoles work, though? I mean, Apple's always had a very game console-like market. Like, you buy your Nintendo, you buy your Xbox, and we can't even get them to do Fortnite cross-compatible without a huge argument.
Yeah, it is similar to that. Yeah, it is similar.
I think that a lot of, maybe there's some small percentage of Apple users that really care. You know, I think that the bottom line is that most of us just want it to work, and it works better when it is a closed environment. You know, I do think that fundamentally, and our listeners can tell us whether I'm right or wrong, but I think fundamentally most people who are using an iPhone actually are less geeky about their phone than someone that is in an Android. There's a very small percentage, and I mean less than a tenth of a percent probably, that really care whether they're in a closed system or not. Oh, they just like the fact that everything installs correctly and works. You know, they just don't care. You know,
I really don't like that argument whenever it comes up. If this situation affects you, then that affects 100% of the market that you care about. So sometimes some people are going to think that there's a principle involved, and that in principle, I want to have the ability, once Apple decides to ditch support for my phone, if I still think that it's a fine phone and I want to continue to use it, even as a music player, it would be nice if I could simply flip a switch and simply say, here's some really, really weirdos out there, weird men and women who are still developing apps for, out of nostalgia or because they really like their iPhone 4 to create a suite of apps that really works well on this. This is, again, something that you can do on other platforms. There's actually a whole third-party kind of compatibility suite for other phones that once their manufacturer kind of drops support for them, you are able to then go in and say, okay, I guess this has stopped being a Google phone, and now this has started to be this open-source repository sort of phone. Again, I admit that is a small percentage of the user base out there. But if you are one of those people that either wants or even needs this to happen, that is 100% of the market that you care about.
Well, I guess I would say if you're that 0.001% that think that that's important, you should buy an Android. like you have another choice. Well, buy something else.
Maybe you've spent $800 on a phone it still works great. The screen isn't cracked. Apple isn't even making phones of that size anymore. Touch all these buttons. Click all these things off the list. And again, I own it. I paid money for this. Here's my receipts for it. And now I have to stick it in a drawer not because of limitations of the hardware, but because there is sort of a diplomatic policy that the regime known as Apple has decided to inflict upon the citizens of iOSville. I don't think it's inappropriate, regardless of the motivations of those people who are bringing the suit, to force a court to decide, is this okay? Should a company be forced to say that at some point we have to release our control of this device and let the people who buy this actually do what they want with it?
I don't know if it's not legally relevant, but it might be kind of related. Apple, remember, lost almost $500 million lawsuit in the iBook store issue, where they were accused of price fixing with publishers the price of books in the iBook store, and as a result raising the price for all consumers. And they lost that case and had to pay a fairly hefty fee.
Yeah, the U.S. is hugely low price sensitive. Like, most of the EU decisions are based on how competitive the market is. Most of the U.S. decisions are based on what can deliver the lowest price for the consumer. So Apple got squashed, Amazon got boosted, and prices are low, but you have effectively no competition in that market now. So it really is a geographic preference at this point. And a lot of people will say that we need to just totally redo how all these laws are interpreted, because – and Ben Thompson's aggregation theory is a good example. Things just don't work the way they used to.
Yeah, Ben actually has a very good article in Stratechery today about this antitrust suit, and talks about the standing and so forth. So you can read that argument and why he thinks, and I think the Supreme Court will eventually rule that even indirect purchasers of app store apps do have standing to sue over this. He also, though, says Apple's right in this case. He says Apple has power over developers precisely — this is the aggregation theory you were talking about, Renee — precisely because it has all the consumers' demand. In other words, it follows then it's far more likely developers are pricing according to what the consumer market will bear and internalizing the App Store fee, as opposed to artificially pricing them higher to pass on that cost to consumers.
It's going to be almost impossible for them to demonstrate, here's how high the prices are in the App Store. Again, $50 for a simple note-taking app in the late 90s. $100. I was killing myself looking at old catalogs the other day. Like, oh my God, I could not afford to own a computer. I could afford to own a computer, but I could never afford to own more than like two or three apps. Thank God that I believed in piracy when I was 19 years old, or else I never would have learned anything.
Thompson also points out that the Supreme Court assumed that Apple was an abusive monopoly, that many of the questions took that as given.
Yeah, as a given.
And part of the reason that the prices went down was specifically because when the prices were high, everyone I knew, when we got started, we all pirated a lot of software, because that was the only way we could get — I could never afford Photoshop. I mean, I had to wait until I could afford a scanner. So the thing is that all of us pirated software in our teens, at least, and that affected the price of everyone. A closed system that's highly secure, that makes sure that everyone's paying for it, means that the price also can be lower, you know, and so for everybody. And so, you know, that there's a tax to an open system that is that you have to charge as a software manufacturer, because, you know, you're only selling to 20% of the people that have your app.
Well, you know, and that's I mean, it's clear that prices are cheaper for apps than they were for and still are for desktop software. You can make that argument, but I'm not sure if that's the piracy tax, Alex, or if it's because Apple has put pressure on developers to charge less for their apps.
I would argue it's commodity. There's just before apps were so rare that there was real demand for them, and now they're commodities. They're everywhere. There's 19 different Twitter apps. There's 300 different calendar apps, and you simply even Photoshop. Photoshop was a monolith, and now there's so many different alternatives that you went from a market of rarity to a market of ubiquity, and it's impossible to maintain pricing when software is. And this has happened to everywhere. Like we saw media, you just have to go and buy your newspaper, buy your magazine. And now there's so much available online, and it just goes industry by industry. As it becomes digital, the surplus far exceeds the demand, and the whole pricing structure inverts.
Mm. Yeah. It's a big question about how the plaintiffs will be able to successfully pursue this case. But one of the arguments that fails for me personally is when the argument is made that, we've made such a great decision for you, and let me show you the flip charts on how well, how badly off you would be if you didn't have this monopoly or you didn't have this system in place. Again, sometimes it's a case sometimes it's a case where somebody thinks it's a point to be made that, again, I own this $600 phone. I want to be able to do what I want with it. So.
Yeah, the arguments between you and Alex are really about Alex is very pragmatic. Look, people just want it easy and simple, and you're making a larger, I think, more philosophical
point. In principle, right?
I mean, yeah, a point of principle. The interesting thing here, and of course, this is according to Ben Thompson. Even if the Supreme Court rules the plaintiffs don't have standing and says, you know, you can't pursue this, it isn't the end of it by any means. First of all, he points out, most states, including California, don't follow the Illinois BRIC precedent. So he says there's a decent chance the question of whether or not the App Store and Apple's associated policies are an antitrust violation will probably make its way to court sooner or later in some other form or fashion. Apple is not out of the antitrust hot water.
Well, and I still think that the number one thing that protects Apple to some degree is Android, you know, is that Apple is such a small percentage of the overall market that I think that is a steep hill to climb for most antitrust conversations, because you do have a much larger choice.
Yeah, but if you're Amazon, and Ben brings this up, and you can't put the Amazon store in the Amazon app, that means a whole 50% of the market in the United States is not going to be able to buy books and Kindle books from the Kindle app or Audible books from the Audible app on iOS.
And Amazon wasn't selling Apple products for a long time, so the biggest retailer couldn't buy Apple products.
Right? That could be problematic if someone were to decide to sue that. The iBooks app can sell books to consumers without a 30% internal markup. However, the Kindle app and the Comixology app has to kick back 30% to somebody else. But
the
again,
there's no room for double middlemen anymore. Like you have the creator and you have the purchaser, and there's room for one person to have the agency fee of like 30% or 15%. But you start to put two or three agencies in there, you want to have Amazon and Apple in the middle, and there's just not enough money to go around. Not unless you start screwing creators again, like we did for many years.
This is an example of rent seeking. Apple does nothing to increase the value, for instance, of Netflix shows or Spotify music or Amazon books, or any number of digital services from any number of app providers. They simply skim off 30% because they can. That's you couldn't argue that, right?
Is anybody or 15 disagree? Now for well, it's 15, 15 now for Netflix. 30, but that's minor. Right. Yeah. It's an access fee.
But the point is they're not adding any value except by
other than building the best market for selling an app in the world. I mean, you know, like it's
no, I'm not talking the App Store. I'm talking about Spotify too. I'm talking about Amazon Books. I'm talking about Netflix. Not merely the App Store. Any purchase, in-app purchases.
Yeah. Any purchase. You can also make the argument that okay, fine, developers, you want to be able to make and sell apps to directly to consumers without our interference? Great. You don't get to use Xcode anymore, and you don't get to use our wonderful APIs anymore.
Say that. That's true.
I'm saying that to play devil's advocate, they put a lot of value. Apple could make the argument that they're making, it's not 30% off of sales of everything that they do, that they are funding the development cost of this wonderful development platform and all of the tools to make it work and all the APIs to make all the software easy to make. And that's basically what
is that worth $3 a month per subscriber to Netflix, though? That's a lot of money.
I think that's a choice that Netflix has to make.
Well, look at Fortnite, which decided it didn't want to pay Google's 30% and be on the Play Store.
But I mean, it also subsidizes all the free apps. Like both these platforms make all these apps available, and they handle a transaction and the virus checking and the storage and everything for those apps absolutely for free. And that money comes from the pool of money it collects. They certainly make tons of profit too, but that comes from the pool of monies that they collect. And they do storefront marketing, the App Store and the Google Play Store are still some of the best places for discovery. And you get prime real estate in that when you're inside. There's a whole. You just have to decide. I remember Craig Hockenberry wrote a post when they first announced the App Store saying, you have no idea how much we used to pay for processing and web hosting and this, and people would download our apps. And
Ingram
anything went
Micro
wrong,
used to take half, right? When you went to a software distributor.
Stores take 55%.
Yeah.
I mean, just to process your credit card and provide a charge for a long time was 22-25%, sure. And that was just due to the gateway.
But it's not anymore, we should point out.
It's not anymore. No, it's 2.5%.
Yeah. I know I write a book, for instance, which I don't do anymore because it's not profitable, that you get a percentage, usually 5-15% of half the cover price because the publisher's only getting half the cover price. The bookstore is getting the other half.
Yeah.
So this is, believe me, this is nothing new. This is how retail works in the United States. And if anything, it's flatter than it used to be. Because if you sell software, you don't have to go through Ingram Micro. You don't have to print a box and put it on discs and all the other costs associated with it. Apple does the downloads. I think most developers probably are happy to give them the 30%, but that's not neither here nor there. In any event, this is not a conversation that's going away because this is just the Supreme Court deciding whether this lawsuit can go forward. If they say yes, we'll be talking about this 5 years from now when the lawsuit finally comes to a head.
This is something that Tim Cook's successor is going to have to deal with as well.
Exactly.
This is in the olden times, they used to design cathedrals, and the person who comes up with the plans for the cathedral would die knowing that it would make them knowing that my job is to hand it off to the next generation of people because this will never be finished within my lifetime. And lawsuits are the same thing, where they know that at some point I will be either arrested or shot to death by somebody who was annoyed by what I did, or even just by old age, and I have to groom the next generation of lawyers who's going to figure out what to do with the suit that we just bought.
My analogy is something a little closer to home. When you buy a bottle of Louis XIII cognac, 100-year-old cognac, the winemakers who started that cognac are long gone. Many
generational
problems.
Yes. Why is that cognac so pointy? I thought that bourbon was supposed to be smooth.
And Leo, when are we gonna have that for Christmas? Come on, Leo.
Oh, we really should for our holiday show.
We should
get a bottle. Much is it? It's expensive, isn't it?
I think it's like $3,500.
Hey, if Pharrell can do it, I can do it. It's a beautiful bottle too.
It's the iMac Pro of brown liquor.
Let's put it this way, Alex. If you come in for a Twit holiday show on December 23rd, I will have a bottle, if I can get one, but in that time, of Louis XIII waiting for you.
I'll be there.
All right. Now I have to find out where I can buy it. I've been at restaurants and I've tried to get it where, you could, it's like.
You can actually get it. You can actually get it at Willoughby's.
Really? Willoughby's in Petaluma has it?
They have a lot. That's actually better than BevMo.
Willie B's in Petaluma has Louis XIII?
They did about a year ago.
I just want the bottle.
I just looked at it.
I'll give you the cognac. You can keep the cognac. I want the bottle. All right, Alex. So make a note of that, Carsten. This is how we're going to get people to come in on December 23rd. We're going to offer them Louis XIII. Just a fingerful. No, you can have a. I'll give you a
Andre the Giant's finger.
Andre the Giant's finger. Let's take a break because I have some brandy to pay for. What have I done? What have I done? Our show today brought to you by Slide Belts. This is a little bit more reasonable of a gift for the belt wearer in your family. Now, I stopped wearing belts, as I think a lot of people of a certain girth have, because belts are a medieval solution to holding your pants up. The belt, this may go back to cavemen, a strap of leather with four or five holes in it, and you better fit one of those holes. The problem is it's always either too tight or too loose, right? It's very rarely fits perfectly, which means either your pants fall down or you can't breathe. Slide belts is a 21st century solution to that problem. This is a slide belt. See that? Those are ratchets. 32 independent ratchets, which means 32 sizes to fit you. So here's what happens. When you buy the slide belt, you get the buckle separate, and they have a variety of beautiful buckles. This one is the antique brass. I have one that I have engraved. I love this. I actually have two of these. One is on my belt, but this is a buckle just so you can see it. This one says Twit, but this would be a great gift. Put Dad's initials on it. If you have a wedding coming up, groomsman's gift. And then you get the straps separate, and they have a huge variety of straps, everything from casual canvas to the beautiful, high-quality, full-grain and top-grain leather straps. When you get the strap, it's separate from the buckle. The first thing you're going to do is cut it roughly to size. So they actually have measurements on one end of the strap. So you could say, well, you know, usually I'm about 38 inches or I'm 40 inches. So you cut it there and then you insert it into the buckle. These buckles are swappable. So you can have multiple straps and multiple buckles and mix and match to make yourself happy. I'm going to put this in here. It's very easy to do. Just goes right in this little slot and locks down. And it's, boy, when they lock down, they will not come out. That is, now this is a belt. It's attached. Now, put it on. You've got it close to the right size. But when you put it on, you're going to use the ratchets to get it just perfect. And listen, this is the sound Lisa hears every morning as I cinch up my belt. But here's the sound you hear when you have a little too much turkey at the holiday festivities of loosening the belt. No one will know. Get it just the right ratchet, and that way you're comfortable, but your pants don't fall down. It's about time they invented a belt that actually works. Slide Belts by Brig Taylor, and they're beautiful. It's a great gift because they got every kind of style and fashion, colorful belts for kids, skinny belts for women. And if you have a Ron Swanson in your family, a Nick Offerman type, somebody, an outdoorsman, a woodsman, or woods lady, somebody who really loves to be in the great outdoors, you will like the Slide Belt Survival Belt. This is a buckle like no other. It has inside, let me show it. I can open it up. There's a knife. By the way, it's very sharp, and a bottle opener. It all in the belt buckle. Don't try to get through the TSA with this. And it's got a flashlight, a very bright LED flashlight you could take out of the buckle so you're not lost in the woods. And if you're a Boy Scout and you will like this, you could start a fire with a fire starter on the other end of the flashlight. It's a 4-in-1, make it 5-in-1 because it's also holding up your pants, belt buckle, the survival belt. And I tell you what, this is a great gift for somebody. They're going to laugh. They're going to howl. They're going to say, oh, what a funny idea. And then they're going to use it. They're going to love this. Slide Belts. They offer watches now with swappable watch bands for the ultimate customization. And before you check out, go to the gift tabs section on the website for some great offers. Do note that the gift tab stuff is already discounted, so our offer does not apply. Slide Belts, 1-year warranty, free exchanges, no hassle returns. All of that makes it a perfect gift this holiday season. If you're ready for a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit and use the code TWIT at checkout. You'll get 20% off your order. slidebelts.com/twit. Don't forget to use the offer code TWIT for 20% off your order. I'm taking this home. This is my survival belt. Don't mess with me. Moving on, Apple stores, they're doing some events. They're kicking off the free hour of code sessions next week, and new Swift coding club materials are now available. For me, coding is the most fun. I love to do it. I had to do this in the bad old days when you were on your own using Apple Soft Basic. We've come a long way, and I think there's a lot of kids. It's interesting that Apple shows, actually it's 9to5 Mac, but I suspect this comes from Apple's own branding, some kids with iPads and Sphero's, which is a kind of coding you can do, absolutely. Computer Science Education Week. Starting today, students can register for thousands of free hour of code sessions. They'll be available in-store at all Apple Store locations starting December 1st, running through December 14th. I think this is really awesome.
I've gone every year. They're terrific.
Oh, do you go? Oh, fun.
I take my godkids. And then every year there's something different. Like they did make your own video games and they did Swift Playgrounds. Last year they did the Sphero. It wasn't BB-8. It was the evil BB-8. but they got to learn how to make it roll. And they have a really high ratio of Apple Store employees to the kids and really good programs. And they often play, you know, really famous CEOs or coders. You know, it's inspirational videos. Oh, and it's just really well produced.
This is the Swift Coding Club. This is something new. Now, the Swift app on iOS, what do they call it? The Swift Playgrounds are really great. This is a little different. This is, I guess, for a learner who maybe wants a book kind of thing. And of course, you'd still be using Swift on a computer. But it integrates with the Tinker app, which I'm a big fan of, Tynker. Problem solving with algorithms, make my sandwich using the Keynote template provided. So this uses Keynote, make a sandwich by dragging your choice of fillings onto the sandwich template. So it's teaching kids kind of the fundamentals of algorithms, debugging. They're using the Tunnel Bug video game for debugging. I really think this is, and I think the intent of this, I would guess, is for a teacher or a parent to download this and to set it up and to work with the kids on this. And you're going to learn, the fundamental computer science concepts and in a fun, practical and engaging way. I think this is really great.
And I was talking to Guillermo Rambo the other day, and he said that he's even just put the blank playground in there and quickly wrote a couple classes and then exported them and used them in his app. Neat. So, I mean, like you can really, like you can't really scale this thing, but you can scale this thing. And it gives you a lot of the fundamental skills, and they're providing it for free. You know, all you have to do is sign up. And I encourage you to do that because the slots, there are limited slots. So take one when you can.
Thus teaching the most important programming lesson of all. Finding the code you need elsewhere and cutting and pasting it into your own project.
Absolutely.
Back when I was doing it, when I started, it was the magazines of code, and you would literally sit there and
type in compute. Remember that?
Yeah.
Nightmare.
Someone was telling us in Eastern Europe that they could, I think it was the Commodore 64, but they radio stations would actually play the code from the tapes over the air, and you'd record it and then put it into your computer to play.
So somewhere in the Inotco archives, I have a couple of old computing magazines from the mid-70s that actually has a vinyl flexi disc actually bound into it. So you pull it out and actually put it on a turntable and then connect it to the cassette port. And it has the idea of having a vinyl record of the software. That really makes me feel old that I was alive when this was a thing.
That's so great.
Now, I don't want to sound negative, so I don't mean this to be negative.
But it's so much fun to be negative.
It's just a question. Well, see, I learned, as all of you did, anybody of a certain age did, pretty much self-taught, right? And then at some, typing in programs from magazines and then fixing them and then hacking code. And you learn, it's not a good way to learn to code by any means. It's spaghetti code and you're hacking it together. And then at some point, many of us got something a little more formal, but usually that was later. That was in, college level classes.
Comp sci.
And that's a very different way of learning. So I have no experience. I don't even know any kids who have learned in this way, learning through apps and the modular things. We talked, I think, maybe about this, Alex, a couple of weeks ago. Or I'm looking at the way they're teaching this in this booklet from Apple. Does this work?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just starting to do it with my kids. And so my kids have been doing this with playgrounds, and they are definitely playing with it. And a lot of what we have to talk about more than anything else is what do they want to do with it? You know, what do you want to do with it? There has to be a problem. I think that the hard part of learning anything like this, or pretty much any skill, is you have to have a project to work on. And so having that project to work on and then going back to find out how to do it is really always going to be one of the most effective ways to learn it. And then, of course, what you need is some expert help to make that work. And I think that I think that the problem really is they have to make it really interesting. I think that when I look at this, I've said this before, but the problem with school is that it's all run by people who were good at it. And so I think the challenge right now is there's a lot of stuff here that is done by folks that are really good at, they understand a lot about pedagogy and all the things that are there. I think that I think it definitely has the right core of the coding ideas and process. I think that we need to find ways to get to the kids that maybe aren't as engaged, that might be just excited about trying to fix, trying to do something. And so I think that I find my kids are really engaged with, there's a maker after school thing that is in Novato and my kids go, my son goes 4 times a week after school. And I think he gets more out of that than he gets out of school. And my daughter goes 2 times a week. And there's in fact, on Thursdays, it's like girls only.
I really think that's important. We talked about that on iOS really today, and there's a new Apple's a new program for promoting women run startups.
Oh yeah, the entrepreneurs program.
Yeah, yeah. And at first, I think some people's reaction is, well, why are they giving girls special, treatment? What about boys? But honestly, I'm sure your daughter Isabella faces this. I know my daughter did. If you're in an environment where it's mostly guys and one or two girls, the girls tend to get steamrolled. And don't get to participate. And I think it's why so many women don't like math is because, they kind of got steamrolled in school and never got a chance to really enjoy it. And there's no reason, no intellectual reason why women can't run companies. I know that because my company's run by a woman, can't write code, can't be technical. And I think the best way to promote diversity is doing what Apple's doing, which is it's kind of like affirmative action, is providing
there
special
was a program
for girls.
Scott Forstall started a long time ago at Apple with Don Melton and a bunch of other people, where they realized that in order to increase the amount of women in the teams, that they wanted to do, they had to include women in the entire range of process, from going to the schools, because sometimes women wouldn't approach men at booths. They wanted to have women in the booths. They wanted to have women reviewing the applications. They wanted to have women doing the interviews.
You go to a trade show, at least until recently, and they're staffed by booth babes in skimpy outfits. That's got to be off-putting to women. That's not an environment
absolutely
that promotes.
And so this, when you look at what Apple's doing, it's not just for the women, but it's run by a lot of Apple has incredible women. Cheryl, who runs all the developer stuff, including Swift Playgrounds, and Adele, who runs the messages, and Vicky, who runs JavaScript for Mac. There's just so many amazing women engineers there, and it looks like they're the ones who are actively involved in all this, and that's the best indication that this is being taken seriously.
Yeah. This is for, it's called Apple Entrepreneur Camp, and it's for organizations founded and led by women. We believe apps for everyone should be made by everyone. And there actually is a strong case to be made that apps which are developed in a monoculture of male engineer types are not going to be as good as apps that are made by people with different experiences, different life choices, different genders. That's good for everybody. The
amount of mistakes they prevent,
also,
at least.
And by the way, as we get into artificial intelligence, it's going to be more and more important, and we've already seen that AI, machine learning, does not have these inherent biases. That's going to make it terrible.
I think that also that a lot of us build apps. The first apps that I built, and even the things that I still build, whether it's with my own code or not, but all the things that I'm doing, I'm fixing problems that are in my life. So I have I have an itch to scratch over something isn't working quite as well as, and I can't find another solution for it. So I either write it myself or I have somebody else write it for me. And I'm constantly solving these. These are my problems. And these are, as a male that's in technology, these are the problems that I have. Women programming, women solving those problems are going to solve an entirely new set of problems that are their problems. They're looking at every day there's something that is a problem for them, and they'll build an app for that. Or they're going to build some kind of technology for that. But it's going to be women centric, and that's still half
CR1
market.
Says in the chat room, the vast majority of fart apps are written by men. I think that's safe to say.
I would agree with that.
It'd be way more innovative if they weren't.
Although I don't know. I don't know if I'd put it past my daughter. She's got a pretty rough sense of humor.
Anyway, get back to this notion, I mean, there's two reasons, more than two probably, but there's at least two reasons why children should learn coding. It's the same reason I think kids should take math. And, you know, when I was in high school, I was, what am I never going to do Algebra 1 in real life? It's not about learning the skills of coding necessarily or the skills of Algebra 1. It's learning a way to think that is very useful later in business, to think logically, to be able to put together, a logical string of ideas, to innovate. There's a lot to be learned in coding, even if you will never again code. And this, look at this. This is from the Swift code book. This is great. Think in bits. Composition and decomposition. This is a programmer concept where you take a larger task and you break it down into smaller tasks. And the way they're showing it is with the cup song video. So it's work in small groups to learn the routine by breaking it into smaller parts. Download the movie into notes or pages. As you watch the movie, divide it into smaller parts, label each section. This is a great way to teach decomposition. Yeah. This is useful as a programmer. You need to know this. It is absolutely part of a computer science curriculum. But it's also useful in general in life. And I think this is a very engaging way to teach it. So this is a lot more than just about using Swift to write an app.
The ongoing question is, the problem is that, of course, any language or any code system that they learn today is going to be probably obsolete or surpassed by the time they actually need to apply it practically. And so how do we teach basic thinking that will help? And I also like the idea of putting a new emphasis on art classes, on music classes, on things that allow kids to develop their ability to think in an abstract way. I'm glad you mentioned, I'm glad that you called out that feature of the curriculum that Apple put together, because I've always thought that if you want to teach people how to program, one of the most, I would put them in a 1-year carpentry course. Because it is about and have them make a desk because it seems like a big horrible thing for like a 10 or 12 year old or 14 year old to make, but then you break it down into smaller pieces and you realize that at the basic level, all I have to do is measure this piece of wood and cut it to a certain length and make sure that it's cut at a right angle. And then the more complex idea is, you're working in a team, is to say, guess what? You're making drawers, and I'm going to be making the part of the desk that the drawer is going to fit into. We need to get together on how your part is going to fit into my part. So when you get kids that young, where their brains literally are still, the hardware is still developing, the software is still being developed for that wet computer inside their heads, I think that it's really, really great to put a focus on what skills do we want to teach them that they can apply everywhere. And I think it should include teamwork. It should include the idea that I'm not making a desk. I'm cutting this one piece of wood, which is important to make the entire desk. I've got a clear goal in mind, which is to make a desk. We have a way to test to see if that is a desk or just a pile of wood that is really ripe for kindling. All this sort of stuff that will help them get along in any industry that they get in with. I would love if all public schools were funded well enough to teach classes and everything. But as I grow older and as I look at the skills that really were the most valuable to me as a kid, I'm starting to think that if we can fund a coding program or a well-thought-out carpentry workshop program or well-thought-out art program or well-thought-out music program, I'm thinking that these arts and crafts segments are going to help out these kids a lot more than learning specifically how to write JavaScript or PHP or even Swift.
Swift Coding Club, highly recommended. I'm very impressed having read through this. And it would be a great thing for maybe an after-school club to start. This is kind of perfect for middle school, I would say. Maybe we'll do this at home with Michael and his friends. He's 16. He wants to learn how to code. And I agree with you 100%, Andy, that these skills are transferable and they don't actually only come from computer science. They might come from carpentry.
I think the most important thing that I've learned that I probably use from coding more than any code that I ever wrote was, when something's going wrong, reduce all the variables and slowly add the variables back until you figure out which one's broken. I mean, that is something that I use in all parts of life. And I think that that's super important.
100%. My life got so much better, and I was responsible for so many fewer like catastrophic failures in my life when I learned and embraced the concept of take one step back. What is the goal here? What are we trying to accomplish? Because right. The goal here is not to cut this piece of wood with the saw. The goal is to make this big thing. The thing that's frustrating me right now, is it important we do it as is, or can we achieve the goal someplace else? And it also helps me with things like, okay, does going to the store, buying a week-old fish, coming back into this office and beating someone over the head with this horrible smelly fish, is that going to help us with the goal of getting this project done? No? Okay, then perhaps we should focus on fixing the problem that got caused by the fact that this person did something that was so awful that it made me fantasize about hitting them over the head with a dead fish.
But the fish, funny.
Yeah. I have to say, there's also the possibility, and maybe it's 1 in 100, 1 in 50, I don't know, 1 in 10, that your kid may suddenly say, I love coding. I know that's me. I love it puts me in my happy place when I'm sitting and writing code. I just love it.
Well, the first year when we took my god kids, they wanted to become video game developers. And then when they did the last one with the robots, they wanted to start creating nanites. So it's like it escalates rapidly.
And we need people who understand technology and can manipulate it successfully, because who's going to write our next great fart app? We got somebody. Somebody's got to do
Nanite
it.
Nanite farts, Leo.
Nanite farts. Our show today brought to you by WordPress. Somebody, a guy named Matt Mullenweg, first set up WordPress many moons ago, and I was a WordPress user way back when. In fact, I just got on the WordPress.com app, I just got my 12-year badge at WordPress.com. 12 years I've been using WordPress.com. Even in years before that, I used WordPress on my own server. And I have to say, I really, having the experience in both ways, WordPress.com is 100 times better. First of all, that server was expensive, a lot more expensive than WordPress.com. I was the one who had to install, run, configure, secure WordPress, add the plugins. Hey, I learned a lot about WordPress, and I don't discourage you. That's a great way to do it. As a result, I spent less time blogging, and that's really what your website's all about, is putting content up there. So if you don't want to become a web guru, you don't want to pay extra to host your own server, you don't want to spend a lot of time doing the security and software updates, you gotta go to WordPress.com. Focus on your content, your site. If you're an individual and you don't have a website with your name on it, you're missing the boat. That Facebook page, that doesn't belong to you. That belongs to Mark Zuckerberg. That Twitter account, that doesn't belong to you. That belongs to Jack Dorsey. That, you know, Medium, all these great places you can publish online are other people's sites. You got to have your site. And WordPress is your site. You can upload images, video, audio, and more. It's stored on WordPress.com. You can import and export content to and from your WordPress website. So if you're putting videos up there, they're your videos. They don't go away. And I wish I'd learned that lesson a lot earlier, because I did use before WordPress blogging software where I've lost images. They're gone forever. We were talking the other day about moblogging. I put a lot of images on Text America, hundreds of them from the early days of Tech TV. They're gone forever because I didn't own that site. From now on, my content goes to WordPress.com, my LeoLaporte.com blog. If you've got a business, it's even more important that you have your place on the web, a place where, you know, it reflects your business, your style. You put information. If you're a plumber, you could put videos up there on how to fix stuff, on how you guys work. That's what people are going to find when they search for your business name, your personal name. You need to own that. And then, of course, you can grow your audience. You can reach new customers. They've got built-in search engine optimization at WordPress.com. Social media features like social linking, which means your customers can share news and information about your business on their Facebook and their Twitter. And that's awesome. And you can launch your website with confidence knowing you can get help from a 24/7 support team anytime you need it. WordPress plans start at just $4 a month. Did you know 32% of every site in the world, almost one-third of all the sites in the world, it'll be one-third soon, run on WordPress? There's a reason one-third of all the websites in the world run on WordPress. Right now, get 15% off any new plan purchase when you go to our special URL. Please use this. That way they'll know you saw it on MacBreak Weekly. Go to WordPress.com/MacBreak. WordPress.com/MacBreak to create your website and get 15% off a brand new site, WordPress.com/MacBreak. I love HeavenlyOlaporte.com. In fact, I have all these blog posts in process, one of which I just want to write down. I was going to do it for this week. I didn't get around to it, but maybe in a future MacBreak Weekly, a list of all the command line apps I use Homebrew to install on my Mac, and why I've installed them. And there's more than two dozen. I've started that post. That's a perfect example of something where I can put something on WordPress.com that I can't do in the detail I'd like to on the shows, but I can refer you to from the shows. Yeah, there's some really cool Homebrew command line apps out there. Andy, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to add that I've been blogging since before there was a word for blogging, and I wrote my own CMS out of AppleScript and then other software that was the last really huge programming project that I built and maintained. And then I switched to like a self-hosted WordPress site. And last year I started for a new project. I tested out a WordPress hosted site, and I'm not going to be a hero anymore.
No,
it's so much. It's just as you say, all I have to do is blog, and the mistakes that I make will do nothing to compromise the stability or security of the site. It will just make my site look ugly because I chose bad fonts and bad that's such a relief, Leo.
I know. And then, by the way, you blog more because you spend less energy, tweaking, and more energy putting content up.
And also, when I start getting like 100 tweets saying, "Oh, did you know that I'm getting PHP scripting errors on your site?"
Oh, so, God.
Yes. Okay, I guess what I'm going to be doing for the next two or three days is trying to figure out what plugin is doing what. Whereas I could just yell it. I could yell at WordPress. If under the incredibly unlikely scenario that my WordPress hosted blog stopped working, it's someone else's problem. And in this world, is there a better trio of words than somebody else's problem?
Yes.
I don't think so.
Because I'm not on social media anymore, which has been a really great thing for my mental state. I have to post, but I still want to put pictures up, right? So easy. You just, by the way, my WordPress front page has hero images from the past. This is this looks like a Photoshopped. This is a real image of a giraffe. I was at the San Diego Safari Park, and the giraffe stuck its head over to see what I was doing on my phone. And you know what?
Password.
Giraffes are sweet.
Change your password.
You got my password. That password.
It looks like a really shifty giraffe.
I know. This is a WordPress template called 2017. It's really, I could put pictures up there. So easy from the WordPress app. This is a slideshow from SmugMug that's easy to import into WordPress and post there. You can see I've also posted links. On the right there is my news link. So when I put a news story up, it automatically goes there. There's just a lot. There's the photos from Flickr in there and the shows that we've just put out. Oh, I should mention, we just put out Valley of Genius episode 12 with Andy Hertzfeld. That's a good one. You Mac, Apple people will want to hear that one. So I really love having a blog. I forgot how great it is. And not doing social media really has helped give me more time to post there. I think that's better. I own those pictures. I won't lose them. God, that it broke my heart when Text America. Do you remember that? Moblogging? Maybe that's just me.
Yep.
Let's see. Apple's next move in health monitoring and improvement, according to Apple Insider, might be sleep monitoring hardware. I think we've all realized that the Apple Watch is never going to have any sleep monitoring first-party stuff from Apple.
And didn't they buy a sleep monitoring company in the last year? Yeah.
But I think the reason that Apple isn't going to put it on the watch is because people put it in the charger at night. You don't, most people don't wear their watch to bed. So Apple acquired a sleep tracking company called Bedit. Remember Bedit last year?
Yeah.
Bedit made a band, you see, that goes on your mattress.
Well, it's an Apple Watch accessory, Leo.
Yes, that makes much more sense, doesn't it? And actually, I use something from Serta that goes under the pillow, not the pillow, under the mattress, under my head, that does it. And it's nice not to have to wear something to bed to get your sleep tracking information. So Apple filed some patent applications November 22nd for a multi-element piezo sensor for in-bed physiological measurements to measure more. It actually kind of looks a little bit like the first version looks a little bit like the Bedit sensor. The other looks a little bit more like the Serta sensor. It's a larger array of sensors that covers the entire bed in a grid.
And can sense zones.
Yeah.
So it's good for sensing movement and also for finding out that why were there two people in the bed last week when I was in Poughkeepsie, Ed?
We actually I get that information. And when we're out of town, I know how well our son has slept and whether he slept alone. Fortunately, yep.
That's what the owner of Ecobee told me the first time I spoke to him. He said, I was in Europe with my wife and we saw our living room had two people, then five people, then 25 people. And I just called home and I said, darling, are you having a party? No, Dad. Are you sure?
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Kids today, I feel bad for them. They can't get away with anything.
And it's on YouTube. Even if you don't catch them, it's on YouTube the next day.
Speaking of acquisitions, go ahead, Danny.
But that is a really, really good area for any health interested company to get into, not only for sleep tracking, but also for is the person in the bed, is the person not in the bed? Because especially when you get people who might have diminished capacity or elder care, you need to know if this someone who needs supervision for a caretaker to know that, okay, well, I thought that this person is asleep in bed. He or she has just gotten out of bed. I need to go and investigate that immediately before there's a fall. So there's a lot you can do with those sensors.
Apple. There is a downside, though. There was that story earlier in the week. I forget who retweeted it, but this person needed the medical equipment, so they called their insurance company. Insurance company said, we'll help you tune it. Just put it online for us. And then they still didn't get it, so they called up, and they said, we weren't using it for long enough. And they said, well, because you didn't help me tune it yet. And then they canceled it on them.
NPR had a big blockbuster story about that, about people with CPAP machines that now communicate back to a central server because it's ratting you out to the insurance company on how often you're using the machine. And if you're not using it a minimum number of hours per night, they will basically stop paying for it. It's a really, really great story to look into because we're going to see more and more of these problems as more healthcare companies realize exactly how few limits the law puts on their behavior to make sure that they don't have to pay for anything ever.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a scary.
Why idea. We can't have nice things.
Yeah. Another Apple acquisition, AI company with a privacy first approach, Silk Labs. This is a report in The Verge. Developed machine learning software for tasks like home security and building surveillance. The purchase, which according to the information took place earlier this year, would be a natural fit for Apple's privacy-centric approach to AI. I'm not familiar with their stuff. This is their smart home hub Sense. They raised money on Kickstarter, but never made it. Canceled in 2016.
It's interesting because there is a group of people who are finding Apple increasingly attractive, including John G, who came to Apple from running AI and search at Google, because they fiercely believe in ethical AI, and they're looking around at a lot of what's happening with a lot of companies and algorithms from YouTube to Facebook and really worrying about the future of that technology. And at least for now, they're thinking that Apple is doing it in a way that is more compatible with their worldviews. And that's letting Apple, I think, accumulate talent that might not ordinarily go towards them.
In 2016, anyway, at least, Silk Labs was building an operating system. They came from, we should mention, two of them from Mozilla, where they were working on Firefox OS for smartphones, and a Qualcomm alum. And at least in 2016, they were building an OS designed with infused with AI that would power hardware made by other companies competing in the Internet of Things category. So this is kind of an ambitious and interesting. It may be an acquire where they just got these smart guys to do other stuff. But
that's
maybe
where you get water.
If so, it's a smart one. It's proving Apple's focus on privacy and personal security has been a philosophical one from the very, very start. But it's proving to be a really smart business decision going forward, because every single piece, there's so much trouble that they're avoiding by making sure that there's very little that the EU can do regarding privacy that Apple either isn't already compliant with, or that they can comply with very, very quickly and very, very easily, and not lose a dime from their business model in doing so. And the more they were able to make sure that they can provide Google-like features and Facebook-like features on device without sending anything to a server, the more they stretch their advantage here. So yeah, it's not just philosophical. It's not just dogma. At this point, I bet there's a spreadsheet somewhere that says here's how much money we're going to save in legal fees and exploration alone just by virtue, and also being able to not have to deal with government intrusion into personal data, because hey, we don't even have the data. You're going to have to go after the person who actually has it, which is not anybody who works at Apple. So goodbye. So this is a really, really good move from Apple.
They were also, I guess, in that hub doing on-device face recognition, which Apple would, Apple loves doing everything on device. If you could do on-device face recognition. Does Apple do on-device face recognition in iPhoto?
Yeah, and then it syncs it between, it's all on device, but it will use the secure version of iCloud to sync it between your devices.
Right.
Now.
But the actual thing where it says, oh, that's Leo's face.
Yes.
That's on the phone, not on.
Yeah, they felt
servers.
They had so much silicon overhead that they could just process those things while you in between your two button presses on the keyboard.
That's amazing. Actually, it explains why you're seeing things like the A12X Bionic in the iPad. That overhead is very useful as you can move more and more stuff to on-device instead of server-side.
And that's
and
not
it's
even
got accelerated super AI, too.
Yeah.
Even Google's little click camera that they introduced this year and has absolutely become an icon, a staple of the technology photographic canvas today, it does all the face recognition on device because they are not dogmatically invested in invading people's privacy, unlike Facebook. And they have the wherewithal to simply say, okay, let's just make sure that we are aware that people will be freaked the hell out if we have this device that's always looking, a webcam that is always looking at the room and always taking note of every face that's in there. So it can recognize faces only within the limitation of here is somebody that our user has told us is someone interesting, and we want pictures of our daughter, we want pictures of our dog, we want pictures of particularly of our daughter smiling and playing with our dog. So when that happens in the field of view, please click the shutter. So it's not companies are running out of excuses for not having really good security and really, really good privacy on their devices.
Of course, for a long time, the third rail in privacy has been health records. Both Google and Microsoft had health record systems that they abandoned because they realized, maybe they found out nobody wanted to use them. Apple is in talks to give veterans access to electronic medical records. It would allow veterans, they would build the app that would allow veterans to transfer their health records to iPhones. I would bet, this is from the Wall Street Journal, I would bet Apple's interest is using this as a test case for doing this in a broader group. The VA has 9 million veterans enrolled in the system, so it's not an insignificant test size. But electronic health records, clearly are the future. But it's always been a little bit of an issue with privacy. I certainly would trust Apple more with my health records than Microsoft or Google.
Yeah, absolutely. And everybody needs healthcare. So if you get into a business that makes you a player in healthcare, you're pretty much set after the iPhone becomes so much dust and puffle. So yeah, that's another. Apple is doing so many really, really smart things that are at their desired intersection of do awesome technology, make a buttload of money, but also do things that actually improve situations for the individual users. And so when you talk about making healthcare easier to manage, easier to more portable, more visible to the individual, it not only solves a big problem, but it also makes it gives the platform another really, really big leg up. When people walk into a store, they're not necessarily fans like we are of one make or model. They can switch from year to year if they want to. And if they're once they enter the age where they have a very, very intimate relationship with the healthcare industry, and their general practitioner has told them that, oh, well, if you've got this, here's a system that we're now using, it would be so easy if you wanted to. If you have an iPhone, no? Okay, well, that's too bad. But that's okay. We can make it work with Android too. Just here's a chip card, and here's a login, and here's all these other things you need to do. Then the next time they walk into the AT&T store, yeah,
they're going to buy the same, iPhone.
With pretty much the same amount of money to spend on a new phone. Yeah. They'll remember that and say, well, I think I would like to be able to simply bring in a phone as opposed to a chip card and logins and all this other paperwork.
Well, there's more ways to make money. I don't know if this is the journal throwing shade or if this really is Apple's plans. The company's ultimate goal is to enable patients to import their records and share them with health-related apps, which would use the data to provide services like automated prescription refills. According to people familiar with Apple's plans, Apple would take a 15-30% cut of those subscriptions, as it does with most apps offered through its App Store. With 9 million users, that's a lot of money.
When you start, Apple is often interesting because it's not like they have grand plans for these things, but they look at what they want to achieve and what technologies they have available to them. And when you start looking at what they're doing with Apple Health, which is the health that they run for Apple employees, and what they're doing with Apple Watch as a way of logging in and providing authentication for things, it's not too hard to imagine that you'll have very modern clinics where you'll just walk into, tap your Apple Watch, you know, because it's on your wrist, it gives authentication. That will link your health records to that facility. It'll link your insurance, your payment programs, all the medications you're on, and the allergies you might have. And you'll just go and sit down and wait your turn, and you'll not have to deal with forms or a lot of problems they've run into. Because the interesting thing about Apple's health team is that a lot of them are practicing doctors, like their cardiologists who still spend 20% time in hospitals. Even the marketing guy is still practicing doctors. Spends 20% hospital time, and they're trying to address these sorts of very real problems. And one of them is patients don't remember all the stuff that they're on or what they did, and then it makes it very hard for them to participate in a lot of these activities. But when you have sort of these digital devices that are recording these things and reporting them and reminding you to do things and telling your doctor you did them, it turns the entire industry upside down.
Well, also, when you start monitoring all those things, it's not just reminding you based on time, but it's looking at your heart rate, it's looking at your blood pressure, it's looking at, you know, all of those things. The accuracy, you know, of it can increase dramatically. And it's not something that you necessarily want to give up unless you have all that privacy that Apple is providing. And it's going to be hard for anybody else to provide the same level of privacy unless they control the hardware and the software and don't have a business model, you know, that is connected to using your data. I mean, you know, selling it to other people.
If you were browsing around on your iPhone and suddenly you were redirected to an ad for adult and gift card scams, you might have been scammed by Scam Club. there's a name. iOS users have been targeted by a malvertising campaign via a high-profile ad platform that specifically targeted iOS users. Yeah, you're safe because of the App Store, but doesn't mean you can't be hijacked in the browser. Scam Club, according to this article at ZDNet, has hijacked over 300 million browser sessions over 48 hours, redirecting users to adult and gift card scams. This is according to a cybersecurity firm Confiant.
Happens all the time. We get so many reports of those. Like I get them on every website I go to, even like the Wall Street Journal. I'll be there, I'll load it up, and then suddenly I'll be on a "You want an iPhone from Amazon" webpage.
Yeah.
And I know Apple and Google have tried. Well, Google, I'll get to in a second. Apple has tried to block those, and they figure out ways around the code. Google runs Ad Exchange, one of the biggest ad brokers in the web, but they don't seem able to sort of clip the stuff at the source, which is people injecting malware. Scamware into the ad packages that they update them.
So the trick is these are automated ad platforms. You can buy ads without a human intervention.
Yes.
You put an ad in there that has a slide up that, or you know, in some other way, puts content on the screen that is not the intent of the ad platform, and these people get caught. Here's the spike from Confiant. You see that November 12th, 13th surge in malvertising. That's a big spike. I imagine that it went away because Apple figured out what was going on and did something to block it. That's from Scam Club, boys and girls. Here's some of the – if you did see some of these and were wondering, gee, is this coming from Amazon? No. In fact, look carefully. It's got the Amazon local logo, but it comes from hipstarclub.com. you've been selected to take a short survey to get a $1,000 gift card, Amazon membership or warm card. Here's one from Hipstar Club. Well, hello. Question one, choose one of these women, which I'm happy to say ZDNet has blurred out. Here's another one from Lucky Star Club, a pick drop. This is supposed to look like airdrop, right? Lollipop XOXO from your town would like to share a photo. Decline or accept. That is not an airdrop message.
Decline.
Decline all of that stuff. Confiant has managed to block around 5 million of the estimated 300 million malicious redirects. 99.5% of the affected users were U.S.-based. 96% were iOS users. It abated the next day as the ad exchange removed the malicious ads. Scan Club, though, is not gone. And expect more from Scan Club just in time for the holidays. There's nothing proactively Apple can do about this.
They've tried to prevent the automatic redirects. They've tried to prevent a lot of things. But no matter what they put in place, there always seems to be some way to scam their way around it.
As long as you're going to have websites with ads from ad networks that are not monitored.
You could probably turn off JavaScript, but then you break so much of the modern web.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we spent part of our Thanksgiving, Leo?
What?
Blurring out pictures of genitalia that were being substituted into Wikipedia for assistant-based queries on the U.S. president.
Yeah, that was a weird thing. The Donald Trump Wikipedia page was under attack, and they were putting pictures, replacing the pictures of the president with various inappropriate images. But the weird thing is that it was so prevalent and it was there so long that the Siri and other assistants picked it up.
Apple very quickly shifted it to Wolfram Alpha and web searches, and I'm sure other companies did likewise. But it makes you wonder, like, when hackers can do this, or Stephen Colbert can get everyone to report the elephant as extinct, how do assistants serve reliable data?
Right. Well, I think Wikipedia has a very good system for correcting these kinds of errors over time.
Yeah.
But sometimes there are periods of time where the errors persist.
And they've locked the page now. I think because the attack happened for a second time a couple of days later. And now I think they've just locked the page down.
It shows you how many variables there are and how easily influenced any of these big systems that are relying on public data go. Like if you go to the Google search page and just search for the senator who looks like a turtle, it will return Mitch McConnell. Here are web pages that contain the phrase Mitch McConnell looks like a turtle. I'm talking about you get like one of those like little summary cards. You get his official like summary card. You get like videos featuring Mitch McConnell. So something inside the Google search engine, or maybe some engineer who's responsible for the Google search engine, has decided that anytime someone is asking for the senator who looks like a turtle, they're clearly defining this as Mitch McConnell. And yes, after I found that out, I did decide the turtle, the senator who looks like a duck, the senator who looks like a, and it looks like McConnell got the sole honor of the zoological tag.
You searched
on
all of them, huh?
You have to.
There were a few. Everett Dirksen kind of looked like an elephant, I remember. You know, this is what happens. It's human. It's all I can say. It's human. You end up looking like your pets. You may have heard a rumor about an Apple TV stick. Here's the story from The Information. Once again, they've got some good sources, Aaron Tilley and Jessica Tunkel. To get more viewers for its upcoming TV streaming service, Apple has contemplated going down market on its TV hardware. It doesn't imply they're going to actually do this, but they had discussions about introducing a streaming dongle, kind of like the Fire TV stick you could plug into the back of your TV set. The dongle could make Apple's upcoming video streaming service, which will only be available, we believe, on Apple devices, like the Apple TV, iPhones, and iPads, more widely available.
But probably free for those devices,
which is cool. It's not clear, says The Information, whether Apple will proceed with the dongle idea.
So I heard about this back in 20, I think I actually wrote about this back in 2016. And there was a period, I'm calling it the period in the desert, where there was just a lot of work being done on Apple TV between updates, because there were no Apple TV updates for like 3 years. It was a little bit awkward. And they were trying a ton of stuff. They had a DVR version of it. They had a media center version of it. They had a cable box version of it. And they finally settled on what we got, which was a little black box in the future of TV as apps, which morphed into the future of TV as 4K HDR just, 2 years later. But Apple is so wealthy, and they're such a prototyping culture that almost anything that you can imagine or blog about or YouTube about they have prototyped 10 versions of it and have it running. So those sticks are, as far as I know, absolutely real. The question is, will it ever be productized? And that could depend on the kind of deals they get, because they might also make deals to have it actually embedded in smart TVs.
That's what ended up happening with Roku and Amazon and a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
In the TV. I like that,
In this industry, you have to go to, like, Apple learned this a while ago, too. You can't always expect customers to come to you. For a lot of these kind of things, it makes more sense to go to your customers.
Right. I bought my mom a TCL that had Roku in it because it's easier for her. Our Hisense has a full set of, Netflix and other apps. What's nice is if you get a 4K TV and you don't have 4K external stuff, because you have to upgrade everything with a 4K TV, at least you have 4K in the TV.
I just found that the apps didn't perform as well on the TV as they do on
and
the
standalone. And those sticks, to be honest, don't either. My Roku stick overheats and reboots a lot.
Yeah. I had the same problem. So I have all the sticks. Yeah. But I don't use any of them.
That'd be my guess of why Apple might not do this.
But can they resist the temptation to make the smallest, most ineffective TV remote ever? To surpass what they accomplished with the original Apple TV remote.
The Siri remote.
Oh.
I cued Siri. Yeah, it tried to open Siri remote for me when I said that.
Nice. That's good. That's a useful tool.
It's overly helpful.
Congratulations to the designers, the structural designers of the Apple Steve Jobs Theater Pavilion, that one with the world's largest carbon fiber roof floating on the glass windows. They won a structural award from the people who give structural awards, I guess. It's a 80-ton roof supported by a 7-meter-high glass cylinder. Each has four layers of 12-millimeter thick plies holding up the roof entirely on the glass walls. This is something Steve Jobs always wanted to do. He was always mad that the Fifth Avenue store couldn't have just big glass walls in the top part there. So I think rightly so, a great award.
When physics is your enemy.
Physics, and glass is not the best structural material ever. Has the Fifth Avenue store relaunched yet, or is it still under construction?
I don't remember. Transparent aluminum, Leo, that's what you need. Transparent aluminum.
Let me see if they've, because it's just a big hole in the ground covered up for the last, temporary store location. I wonder when the new one's going to open, because I'm going to be in New York next week. It'd be kind of fun to go see it if it's there, but it looks like it's just a hole right now. Let's see. That reminds me, I will not be here next week. What are we doing, Karsten? Is there anybody going to host the show, or are you just going to?
You're going to be here.
So I will be here next week.
You won't be here for Twig, but you will be here for Mac Break, I believe.
No, I won't.
You won't?
No, my flight's at 1:50.
Oh, okay. Then Megan will be taking over.
Megan will be taking over next week on Mac Break Weekly. I'm heading to Manhattan to freeze my ass off. I thought it'd be easier than losing weight any other way. What's it like in Montreal? Is it really cold right now?
We were supposed to have a huge amount of snow, but it didn't materialize. So it is cold, but it is not as bad as we feared.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous. Actually, Montreal's also on the list. We want to come up and say hi to you and have a Montreal bagel before it goes away.
There's a couple structures. So there's two classic bagels, the St. Viateur and the Fairmount, and they're across the street from each other. And both of them have exemptions, historic exemptions for bagel making, because they have these horrendously pollutive ovens that they bake them in. But there's a lot of other bagel places that use wood burning ovens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what traditionally people landed here. They had trees. That's all they had. So
And these are, Montreal's a really old city. It's not like no one built that in the last 20 years. So they've just had all this stuff, and now it's increasingly illegal, and they can't meet the pollution standards. So they're going to not replace it with microwaves, but they're going to have to do something.
The city of Montreal has declared war on the polluting burners. A bylaw has passed banning the burning of wood in businesses. It would affect approximately 70 businesses, Italian pizzerias, Portuguese chicken joints, and bagel bakeries. They'll have to go to gas or electric, but everyone knows that's no way to cook a bagel.
It's not the it's la droite, Bernac. You just cannot use that stuff anymore.
Look at this. Oh, this makes me pretty. Look at this. I want a bagel.
Did they do any math whatsoever on how much pollution those 70 wood-fired ovens are creating? Or did they just simply say that this is one of those plastic straw things where it says, you know what? People will be happy. They'll think we're doing something. They'll distract from the fact that we're letting all these coal companies do whatever the hell they want. Let's just make things really bad.
Interesting is St. Viateur at least has installed scrubbers.
Yeah.
To comply with the emissions standards, they're trying.
Not enough.
Man, that
it's not
looks
like
good.
We have oil. God, fields in the middle
they're
of
so
it.
Good, Leo.
So how much time do I have? Do I need to come to Montreal like next week? What?
I mean, the sooner the better, just because it'll be great to have you here. But you probably have a little bit of time, and then you don't use. No one here uses they sell Philadelphia cream cheese, but that's not cream cheese. You get local cream cheese. You get wild salmon. You put all that together, Leo, and just you'll never leave with a good poutine on the side.
Here's Fairmont, the city's first bagel bakery, across the street. See all that wood? Think of the trees. Dying, so you could just have a delicious round of wheat stuff eaten.
It's about died of natural causes.
Yeah. Well, I do hope that the Montreal bagel does not go away. This is an opinion piece from the Globe and Mail. Joseph Rosen, the death of the Montreal bagel. Oh, no.
No, it won't die. It'll evolve, Leo. It won't taste the same, but we'll get used to it. And then our kids will say strawberries don't taste the way they used to. Bagels don't taste the way they used to. It's just everything is gone.
They won't evolve,
Renee. It's not a Pokemon. You might want to cut back on your playtime.
I have to point out, Alex Lindsay uses a pellet-fueled pizza oven at his home.
Not yet. I'm waiting for it.
Oh, you've ordered it, though.
I think they're sending one to check out. So
you could probably make bagels in that oven.
I bet you could. It looks like you can make some great.
Our favorite restaurant downtown, Central Market. They have the best bread because they have a wood and pizzas because they have a wood fired oven in there, and it's slightly burnt on the bottom. It's incredible.
I like my gas powered grill, but it's still not as good as a big green egg.
No, me too. Same thing. Yep. All right, let's take a break in your picks of the week, my friends, in just a moment as we get ready to head to Studio B for security now. Our show today brought to you by PayPal, talking about security. When it comes to growing your business, PayPal is the payment partner for today and tomorrow. We use PayPal. I've used PayPal since the beginning of this network as a way to give people a chance to give us donations. It's secure, it's fast, it's easy. Whenever I see PayPal as a payment method, I love it. Take Linda, for example, one of the first online consigners way back when in the early days of internet auctions. She had a hobby. She was liked to locate hard to find items for herself, turned it into a thriving luxury consignment company. You may even have purchased something from Linda's stuff, selling first her kids' video games, then her own clothes online. She's an attorney in New York City. She'd pretend to be in the library doing legal research. Instead, she was out hunting bargains. Scaled her business from her kitchen counter to now a 93,000 square foot warehouse, 100 employees. What a great story, Linda's stuff. And as a company specializing in high-end previously owned goods, reputation, integrity, and trust are critical to how her company operates. Her business is family-owned. Her son joined the company nearly 5 years ago. They celebrate that family spirit with their employees, and from day one, you guessed it, Linda has trusted PayPal to help protect her business from fraud, even when selling internationally. Actually, we pay you through PayPal, Renee, because it's great for international payments. Yep. We don't have to worry about sending you a check in U.S. dollars and you having to convert it and all of that stuff. Linda's stuff is proof positive that with hard work, the right tools and talent, you can grow your business. And she counted on PayPal every step of the way. So should you. With PayPal, your business will find more ways to grow, scale faster, expand to more channels with one payment partner that helps you sell to over 250 million shoppers across markets and platforms. Better conversions, too. PayPal is the most used digital wallet with an incredible conversion rate. On average, shoppers complete checkout 88% of the time. That's amazing. Strong protection, too. You'll feel confident working with a partner that sells, that offers seller protection, readily available customer support, and fraud tools. They get smarter with every transaction. And, of course, clear and straightforward pricing with no surprises. PayPal's been great for us. We use it to pay many of our partners, especially our international hosts like Renee. Explore how PayPal can help your business grow. Visit paypal.com/growth to sign up for free and set up a business account today. PayPal.com/growth. Let's give Alex Lindsay a chance to spend our money. Alex?
Not spending very much today.
Oh, rats. Take it easy.
I was working on my workout, and while I'm traveling, I was really trying to figure out how to do it in the hotel room, and rather than just you having to wait gym and so on and so forth. And I played with a lot of things, and I went back to one that I think I've recommended a long time ago, but I just, after testing a whole bunch of them, I came back to this is still the best one there. And that is Tabata Pro, which is, it seems simple, but it works really, really well. So it's just, the other ones I find are a lot more too complicated. They do a lot of other things that I don't want it to do. And I don't know if you haven't done, Tabata intervals, they're really hard.
Oh my God. My trainer makes me do them. It's the worst day of the week. Tabata Friday.
What
is a Tabata? Tell it. It's like high intensity, right?
So, It's a hit. Yeah, it's hit. Here's the crazy thing about the growth of it. I was trying to explain to my kids what I was doing with Tabata, and they're like, and my son looked at me and goes, oh, that's hit training. We do that like once a week. It's like he was completely
intensity interval training. But Tabatas are, I don't know, they're worse.
You have 8 sets typically. I mean, most common is 8 sets, and you have 20 seconds of full intensity workout, and then 10 seconds of rest, and then 20 seconds on to 10 seconds off. And you'd be surprised at how little weight you can use to completely wear yourself out in 8 sets.
But you need something to do the timing. I mean, that's why I do it with my trainer, because he'll do the timing. We'll do it on a rowing machine or a bicycle. Anything that a ropes machine or the battle ropes, anything that really exerts you, but you need the timing. That's critical.
Yeah. And so, and what's nice about this one is it doesn't interfere if you want to listen to your own mix. So I'll be listening to Spotify, and playing this over top of it. And it kind of just ducks a little bit just as it's talking. And so you can have it all kind of running together, on your iPhone with your AirPods, and everything just works. And you can set it up. Of course, you can make the sets longer or shorter. And it's really, really, it's just easy. I'm not a huge fan of I think that they haven't updated the interface.
UI is a little wonky. Yeah.
It's just a little dated, if you just flattened all of those things, we would think it would look modern.
Right.
So, it looks modern. It looks fine there, and that you can put it on the screen if you want to. And so everything looks it's a little dated, but it's still, I looked at the other ones. I was like, I haven't looked at new ones for a long time. So I downloaded all of them. You're all welcome. Cause it cost me like $20 to buy. Or whatever. And so, and I looked through them all and I'm like, oh, this is too complicated. This isn't, this doesn't do what I wanted to do. The interface, and it's just, it needs to stay simple, because otherwise, you're trying to do something that you're really tired. So you don't want to have to, it has to be something you can just kind of set down in front of you and work through it. And it still works better than any of the other ones that I've used, in my opinion. So.
And it works on modern iOS as well. Because it looks like they haven't updated it in 6 years.
It doesn't look like they've updated it. Maybe they will now after I've talked about it on the show. But I'm using the newest. I'm using an XS Max.
Okay, good.
And
that's the key.
And I'm the newest operating system, and it's all working perfectly. In fact, it works better than I will leave them nameless right now because I'm talking to their support people. But it works better than some other Fit programs that I've been testing as far as interfacing with. I have a pet peeve of turning off my music while I'm, while you're trying to tell me something. I don't need you to tell me anything. I just need you to just be quiet and tell me, just go over top of the music.
Right.
It's fine.
Yeah. Okay, Alex, time to rest.
That's it.
Yeah. I think we should make it Tabata Tuesdays here on Mac Break Weekly. And
nice.
Let's do it.
All of you do. You know, you guys are in good shape.
All I can say is I was like, I haven't done Tabatas in a long time. And I did 8 sets of deep squats as fast as I can. And I couldn't really walk for like 4 days.
Yeah. That's another thing.
I thought I was in trouble.
Monday is leg day for me. I'm waddling around the studio. I do not like leg day. Leg day is no good.
No, it was all week. I did it on Thursday.
So yeah, it takes forever.
Until the following Tuesday. Yeah. I was like, oh my God.
Andy Anako, pick of the week.
I'm just now hungry for tapas.
Not tapas Tuesday.
Taking this the wrong direction.
Tabata Tuesday.
I don't care. You do your fitness thing. I'm going out for tapas. Another food-related thing, we were talking about the $3,000 bottle of cognac. I just wanted to point out that if you go to Amazon, if you go to eBay, you can buy the empty bottle, the signature empty bottle, and the presentation case for like $100, $200. Fill it with whatever you want. And if people leap to the conclusion that the plastic bottle liquor store bourbon that you bought and filled it was actually the Louis XIII cognac, that's on them, because you never said this was the Louis XIII $3,000 cognac.
Wow.
I'm just saying that's
at all, because I think, you know, you're not the one that is going to be coming out on December 23rd expecting bona fide Louis the 13th. That's all
I'm going to Willie B's tonight, and if they have it, I'm picking it up. It will be here. I will find a way. I've never had it. I've always wanted to try it. I hope it better be good.
It was quite good.
Okay.
Do we need cigars too,
Alex?
Oh, yeah, probably.
John's not going to let us have cigars in the studio. Come on, we got the molecule.
You got a wire camera.
We'll put you outside.
we'll sit out there. We'll sit out there and just do the show out there.
Do the show outside so we can have cigars and cognac.
Yeah, there you go.
I like that.
My actual software pick is this really cool reading app called Bookly. Imagine a fitness app, but for reading.
That's my kind of fitness.
It's like you tell it the books that you're reading or the books that you have but haven't gotten to yet. You can scan the barcode or you can just get the information online, and you can set – it will give you goals for how much time you want to spend reading per day. It will give you like performance stats. It will say, hey, if you keep on track, you'll finish this book in the next 4 days. And it's like it really made me think that there should be like a ring on the Apple Watch for I really, really, really have been trying to Finnegan's Wake. I would like to get finished with Finnegan's Wake and see like the next you made your reading goal. You made your goal of actually using your brain to read a book, because I am a kind of a book hoarder. I buy books when they are cheap and put them like sort of in the bank for when I have time or when the mood hits me. And as a result, I sometimes forget that I have all these great books kind of piled up. And so the Bookly will like help me remind me that here are these 8 books you kind of started, but you haven't made much progress with. It's just really, really well done. It'll even when you finish a book, it'll generate this cool, like sort of like infographic that you can then like put on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. So not only does it give you like the sort of like shield awards you get on the watch, but also it lets you sort of needle your friends, just like you're on your Apple Watch. You can needle your friends into saying that, hey, look, I'm exercising way more than you are. And there are other apps like you might think about Goodreads. You might think about other apps that are for like sort of like hobbyist readers. The nice thing about this is that this isn't connected to another platform. The privacy policy looks pretty sound, if not 100% clear. There is a lack of 100% clear statement that says we have apps. We collect your data for just the purposes for which you're using this app. And then we actually print it out on paper and then eat that paper to make sure that no one gets their hands on that information. But the free level has enough good features. I think that it's $30 a year if you want to use unlimited books and unlock features that are kind of nice but are outside of its main bailiwick of here are the books that you've got on your nightstand. Let us help encourage you to make your way through all of those books. So cool stuff.
Nice. I need that. My book stand, I can't even see it anymore. It's piled high.
And it's And it's got to be more comfortable than that leg day squat tabula, whatever thing that you're doing.
Oh, it's Tabbouleh Tuesday. Oh, I can get behind tabbouleh. That.
Ooh, tabbouleh after tapas. I like the way this is working out.
Renee Ritchie, your pick of the week.
So we mentioned it earlier, Leo, and you know I just had to do it, and it is the Pokeball Plus.
Oh, you know, I have a little bit of a problem. I got it for Lisa for Christmas, and then she just told me the other day she's quit Pokemon Go. I guess that means it's mine.
Yes, or you can use it to tempt her back.
Ah.
You can just dangle story. It. What a lovely
story. She quit. Yeah, exactly. She quit Pokemon Go so she could afford like a watch fob.
Yeah, the gift of
but
the
you
Magi.
Sold your watch, you could afford to buy her a Pokeball. Oh.
So anyway, so there was a Pokemon Go Plus for a long time, which was a little device you wore it on your wrist. Yeah, and you would press it to spin Pokestops or to throw Pokeballs to catch Pokemon. This one is similar, but it spins the Pokestops automatically for you, so you don't have to worry about that. You just have to walk past them, and they will automatically spin for you. But it's not like that hacked version of the Mii Fitness Band that does everything automatically, and suddenly you're out of Pokeballs. This still, you press the button to catch Pokemon if you so choose to catch them. You don't have to. So you can just walk and spin your stops and catch on your own, or you can press the button whenever it vibrates and have it catch caught for you. If you're playing Pokemon Let's Go, it also comes with Mew, which is one of the mythical Pokemon from Gen 1, already caught inside it. So you can import him into your game and have a little bit of a head start.
Oh. Do you get a Mew after you evolve it? Can you put it in Pokemon Go?
You can't. So you can transfer from Pokemon Go to Pokemon Let's Go on Nintendo. You cannot transfer back the other way. So I would always be very considered and reserved about what you decide. You might say, I'm putting all my shinies, I'm putting all my good Pokemon, and then realize you can't get them back.
Yikes.
So I would be conservative about how much you transfer over.
Yeah. I didn't realize it auto spins. I'm taking it to New York. I don't care. I'm taking it back. I'm taking it to New York. Because what better place to auto spin Pokestops than downtown Manhattan?
Dense urban areas are the best.
Man, my bag will be full. I'm going to have to expand my bag.
Do it. I just did that.
Oh, I expand it all the time. The problem is there's never enough balls. That's the problem.
Well, they just increased it. So it was $1,500 for a while, and I was living at $1,499, which is just no way to live. And now in the last week, they've increased it to $2,000.
Oh,
and it's just, apparently it was crashing at first. It is a fun game. It is not always a stable game.
It's the most unreal. I had a woman call me on the radio show. I mentioned that she and her daughter played, and she wanted to know if she should get a new phone because her internet was terrible when she played Pokemon Go. And I said, no, that ain't the phone, baby.
All this week, it hasn't worked on Wi-Fi. Like, it won't finish loading the game on Wi-Fi. I turned off Wi-Fi and it finishes loading fine.
It's just the worst.
Yeah.
That's why I'm looking forward to Warner Brothers' Harry Potter version of Pokemon Go. That'll be out next year.
Yeah, it was delayed. Yeah, it's coming out next year now.
Then I'll buy a wand.
And it's supposed to be like a magic beast and where to find them. Yeah. So you go and catch that griffin and you catch that cyclops.
My worst case scenario is they just take Pokemon Go and skin it so all the bugs and everything persist, but my best case scenario is they rewrite it from scratch so it actually works. That would be nice.
I think they're using Niantic's engine, and they've always used Unity as the display, a way to translate their engine into an actual game, but I think we've seen some footage and it looked quite different, so my expectation is going to be low. I'm going to be cautiously pessimistic about this whole thing, and then hopefully they'll surprise me.
I didn't play Pokemon as a kid or even as an adult, so I don't share that nostalgia for that, but I do for Harry Potter. I'll do it real quick because we want to get out of here. It all started with this article in the New York Times, the mystery font that took over New York. I bet Montreal and Cambridge too.
Yeah.
It's that weird font you see on all the sushi restaurants that it kind of looks a little Chinese. It's called Chalk. It was invented in 1955 in France by Roger Excoffon, a French typographer. And for some reason, it's just caught on. It's everywhere. Every Chinese restaurant, every sushi restaurant, they all use Chalk. And I loved this article because, first of all, the New York Times writing about typefaces is awesome.
So great.
Right?
And at least it's not Mistral.
Yeah, or Helvetica. I mean, it's interesting. At least it's not Cartoon Sans. Somebody's going to write that story.
Yeah.
Comic Sans. Why do you still see that everywhere? It's hard to believe.
A virus.
It is a virus. So then I thought, well, maybe my pick should be the font, because as anybody uses code engines, you know, editors, Xcode or works in Terminal, is always looking for a good programming font, you know. And I actually found one now I've put everywhere. I even use it in our chat room. It's called Input, and it's free from the Font Bureau, input.fontbureau.com. They sell a lot of fonts, and it's free for non-commercial use. Designed by David Jonathan Ross, it has a monospaced font, a proportional font. It has a huge range of widths and styles and faces. I mean, it can go on and on and on. This thing just is endless, and I just love it. There's a serif and sans serif version. It, of course, is a programmer's font with the requisite slash through the zeros. Actually, I think it's a dot in the zeros, and it really does a nice job. And it is free. So I thought maybe I'd just mention this. Programmers are often debating over what's the best programming font and so forth. This is one I've really come to love, Input. And you can actually customize it if you go to the download page. Again, it is free with for personal coding or customizing plain text apps. It's not free for commercial use. And if you customize it, you could choose the styles, the families. You could select the character fonts. If you defaults, if you really hate the L's that look like ones, you can get an L with a little loop at the bottom. If you like slashes through the O's instead of dots, you can choose that. How do you like your braces? It's all up to you. You can even do the line spacing and then download the fonts, and they'll be customized. I really like this. They do offer you a chance to support the project by purchasing a license, but it's free for private use. Input.fontbureau.com. I've added that to Fero Sans and Fero Mono, and actually Fero Retina, which is quite good too, and all my other Source Code Pro and Droid and all the others. Ladies and gentlemen,
I thought you were going to recommend Block.
Block?
I was like,
wouldn't it be fun to? Idea. Wouldn't it be fun to code in chalk? The mystery font.
That's
yeah, just code in that, and everything. It's taken over New York. Just code in that. Maybe I will for a little bit. At least run the chat room in chalk. That'd be fun.
Yeah. Speaking of like programming fonts, recently I found the most evil thing to do to a programmer, because the Greek symbol for question mark looks exactly like a semicolon, but it's its own Unicode character. So what you do is you go into their code, you change a random semicolon to the Greek question mark, and then they wonder why their entire app will not compile at all.
None of their code works.
It's like, oh, that is delicious. That is so a move mean. Worthy of a Romulan. That's you almost wouldn't be mad.
Because
it's such a nicely done.
Andy Inako, he's the evil genius at Inako.com. You'll also catch him on WGBH in Boston every week talking about tech, and of course every Tuesday right here. He also has a number of other podcasts, including an Android show, we won't talk about it, called Material.
So good.
On Relay.fm.
Yes, with the amazing Flo Ion.
It's who so
also
good.
Appears on another twit.
Yeah, she's on All About Android, so it makes sense.
And they
sense.
Bounce Russell right out of there. It's amazing.
Relay.fm. We don't plug that enough. All of you guys have your own podcast. Rene Ritchie's got Vector at imore.com/Vector. And, of course, he writes for iMore and is a very welcome guest every Tuesday here. And we got to go up to Montreal and do the show up there. And we can all
please, have please do.
I think that would be so much fun before the end. The end is nigh.
Yes.
Let me see here. Who else? Oh, that's you, Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Core, sitting in front of what is that mountain? That's a pretty mountain. I don't know. Somewhere.
I don't know. I think
is that Whistler?
Somewhere that's got Christmas trees. Someone's got that trees in front of it.
Very festive. if you best way to follow what Alex is up to is to follow him on the Twitter, Alex. LindSay. Ladies and gentlemen, we do Mac Break Weekly Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1900 UTC. If you want to watch it live, you can. twit.tv/live. We have live audio and video. You can watch either. And if you're doing that, make sure you go into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. I found, by the way, and I made this my pick of the week on iOS today, I found the best IRC client for iOS is Mutter. It's free, open source, really good. So I'll be doing more chatting on my iPad Pro. Oh, look, Renee, I wonder how do you hatch an egg by sitting in a chair for 2 hours? No one knows.
It links into the health app on iOS and Android now, so that it'll even when the app is off, it'll count all the steps and stuff you do during the day and give you credit for it.
I know. I love that. That's the adventure mode. Oh, look at the little Skitty. Brand new little Skitty just for me. Oh, that's a Meowth. Never mind. A Meowth. if you can't watch live on-demand audio and video, always available for all of our shows at our website, twit.tv. In this case, twit.tv/MBW. You'll also be able to subscribe in Pocket Cast or whatever your favorite podcast app is. Just search for Mac Break Weekly, and you're sure to find it. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We hope you'll come back next week, but I'm sorry to say, for the time being, you must go back to work because break time is over. See you next time.